Accession number 10304, Reel 2.
Captain Havash, Reel 2.
Yes, I can well remember on one occasion I was on watch for the chief officer, and he suddenly sort of went pews in the face, and he said, "Go down and stop that so and so." And there was a young boy, 8, possibly 9, and he was actually hanging outside the ship on a piece of rope found, you know, over the sea. And he, of course, as soon as he saw me coming, he did a Tarzan act and came inboard and ran away and disappeared in the accommodation again.
Did they do any damage, these children?
Well, I remember one was armed with a large knife, apparently, and he carved his initials in a... The officers... The doors of the officers' cabins were solid teak, I think, of mahogany. Very nice wood, anyway, you know, nice polished wood. And he carved his initials in the thing, you know, and... So anyway, we took the knife away from him. But it was a... you know, it was probably about the worst trip we ever made, I think.
Did any of the children come to harm?
not through accident. I'm sure some of them suffered a few thick ears from the crew at various times, or kick up the backside, but that was all. We didn't have it. But we were certainly glad to see the last of them when they got off at Halifax.
Did they present a pathetic sight, though, being taken so far away from their homes?
No, it didn't appear to be. As I say, they seem to look upon this as a, you know, a sort of a jolly good trip out, you know. But they seem to be uncontrollable. They had, they weren't teachers exactly. There were some sort of escorts went with them. There were none of their, you know, none of their families with them. They didn't have any, you know, any of their mums with them or anything. But there was this. Must have been some organisation. I might have been the Red Cross. I don't know who they were after this time. But and to be quite honest, they weren't. Didn't seem too fussed about controlling them either. You know.
Well, were they from deprived homes?
They were all kinds. Some were from poor homes. Some were gathered from very wealthy. I think the drill was that. If you could afford it, you paid the passage. If you couldn't, the government did it. Again, I'm not... in fact, after it gradually petered out because, as I say, the city of Benares was torpedoed and with heavy loss of life. And it was a rather, you know, dangerous thing to do, to have shiploads of children crossing the North Atlantic, and so I think the scheme gradually petered out. Anyway, as far as we were concerned, we never saw any of them again, thank goodness.
What was the name of this ship, can you remember?
Oh, this ship was the Settler, the same ship. I was still in this is my second ship. I was in it nearly 2 years.
And do you remember the date when you took the children across, approximately?
I can only remember it was in... it would be about the middle of 1942, I suppose. I can't remember the actual date when it ended. So we were crossing pretty regularly. It wasn't bad, actually, because I lived, as I say, in Rhyl, quite near Liverpool. So I used to, when the ship was in port, I got home every night. You know, I'd be able to get home and train, and then I'd come back in time in the morning, you know, in the early morning train. We were away about a month each time, and then we'd have quite a long turnaround in Liverpool. This time we'd all go on leave when we got back to Liverpool as well, you know. So it was quite a good number. But the worst part about North Atlantic convoys, as I say, I was several of them were quite nasty. My ship was never torpedoed. I never got a feet wet, but several ships were, of course. We had one particular convoy was quite nasty, from New York to the Clyde. That was in the early part of 1943, January, February 43. And, you know, we had pretty good escorts by then too, you know, lots of new weaponry and all the rest of it. It was still a pretty nasty convoy. But the thing that stands most in my memory of North Atlantic convoys was not so much enemy action, because, you know, it wasn't going on all the time. When it did happen, it was pretty bloody, no doubt about it. It usually happened in the middle of the night, you know, with U-boats used to get inside the convoys on the surface. That was a technique. They were in these wolf packs because they had the speed, of course, and they used to get in the middle of the night, and of course nobody would see them, they were quite small targets, and radar was in its infancy in those days, of course, and they could torpedo ships practically from alongside, you know. We had the only sort of, because we had no radar at all in any ship I was in during the war. It was only just after the war before I had radar, and the only thing was, once any torpedoing started in the middle of the night, we all used to fire off these what we call snowflakes, which were rockets that burst in the air, very bright illumination of the thing, and that was the only thing we had really to try and spot these things. And but the thing that stands in my mind most was the weather is always abysmal, you know. I think in the nearly 2 years I was on North Atlantic convoys, I think I saw the sun about three times, you know. If it wasn't howling gales and rough seas, it was thick fog, you know, and it was always overcast, you know, and of course in those days we navigated all the time by shooting the sun, and we didn't see the sun, you know. And as cadets, we had to do fix the ship's position every day and present our findings to our sort of sea daddy, who would be the chief officer, you know. He gave us all our jobs to do. While we were in convoy, we were on watch, and there were only two cadets in the Harrison Line ships on each ship, and we were on watch dawns of dusk, and we did all the signalling, for instance, you know, because there was a lot of signalling went on. And the other cadet, on both occasions, were convoys. Now, they came from the Conway, and I was a Worcester boy. They were the same ship. The Conway was on the Mersey, whereas the Worcester was on the Thames, of course. But with the same training, we had the same thing. So we were great help, I suppose, to the officers of watch, because we could do all the signalling for them. And, you know, we were red hot on Morse and lamp and frags and all the rest of it. And we could navigate, you know, as well, you know, we could, and do seaman's work. And when we weren't in convoy, then we were on day work, you know, we worked just during the day. And did deck work, and were supposed to learn how to, you know, do various things. But I'm afraid most chief officers just treated us as a bit of cheap labour, you know, two extra bodies. So much so that in port, we knew that if we didn't sort of do something about it, if anything wanted doing for after working hours, if the gangway rails wanted checking because, you know, the tide going up and down, or the moorings wanted doing, or derricks wanted shifting or something like that, they wouldn't turn out the crew. They'd have to pay overtime to, you know, but two cadets there, they can do it, because we didn't get any overtime. If I had a pound for every hour I'd worked overtime in my life, I'd be richer than anybody. Officers and cadets in those days, anyway, they didn't get any overtime. Another thing, going back to what it was like at sea in those days, the other thing was officers used to work what we call field days. That meant every other day, or every third day perhaps, although you're a watch keeper, you know, you're keeping watches, I think it was every third day, you had to either put in a morning or an afternoon extra work, usually it was overhauling navigation equipment or something like that for free, right? And this was resented, I remember, although it was the custom, it had been going on probably for a couple of centuries, I don't know. And this was resented, quite rightly so. And it was the Navy put a stop to it, actually, because they said, well, look here, if officers and men have to do this field day, you know, they're better occupied in doing gunnery drill or, you know, doing something to help the war effort. Well, of course, this didn't help the ship owners at all. They weren't going to get anything else. The practice died out. So, and of course, that never came back. I think probably a lot of people have asked me anyway, I don't know whether they've asked ever, wartime people, did you hate the enemy, you know, because, you know, he'd been torpedo bombed with the Luftwaffe and mined and all the rest of it. And I think it's true to say that I think the great majority of us didn't. I certainly didn't. I never heard anybody preaching hate against the enemy as such. I think we realise that it was them or us situation, you know. I mean, and the U-boats crew, I mean, they behaved reasonably well, actually, in the last war. In the first war, they had a bit of a, in the Great War, they had a bit of a bad reputation for, and of course it was a new innovation, torpedoing merchant ships, you know. It was against the law, the Geneva Convention or whatever they had in 1914. But we realised from the word go, in the 39-45 conflict, we were going to be torpedoed without warning, and no doubt about it. So I never really, you know, I mean, if Germans were in the water, they were picked up just the same as our side, you know, as you know, survivors. They were shipwrecked survivors, the same as anybody else.
Do you remember Germans on board the ships that you served on?
Yeah, but that, not survivors. I'll perhaps come to that a little later on.
Yes.
As we go on. Not. I never picked up survivors, not Germans. I picked up survivors, not Germans, at sea, actually at sea. But I have had Germans on board, but don't come to. Possibly there was some sort of venom against the Japanese, because the Japanese did behave badly. Some of their... they did commit atrocities against torpedo merchant seamen. There were cases where a torpedo crew were actually put on the deck of a Japanese submarine after they'd smashed all the lifeboats out, and then the submarine just dived, you know, and left them all to drown. You know, the people were shot in the water by the Japanese. The Luftwaffe had a bit of a bad reputation for machine gunning people in the in lifeboats, you know, after they'd been, their ships had been bombed, sank. But I don't think it was it was exception rather than the rule, and it was very exceptional that merchant seamen were ill-treated by U-boat people very often the U-boat came along and said, ha, you know, they try to find the name of the ship. Well, I think if I remember rightly, we were told that try not to give it. But I mean, if they were going to say, if you don't tell us, we'll shoot you. You know, obviously, you know, you under duress, you would give that information. But you tried to keep that from them. The other thing they used to do, they'd come alongside the, because this didn't happen in convoys. You know, I mean, once a U-boat was fighting a convoy, I mean, he didn't hang around at all, quite rightly so. This is when an individual ship had been torpedoed miles from anywhere, and then they would usually approach the lifeboats and try and find. And very often they were quite decent people and, you know, gave them a course for land, and sometimes they even gave them a tow, you know, for a while in the right direction. Made sure they had water. I was with an officer. Then there was the other enemy, of course, were the surface raiders. You know, either the battle, even the pocket battleships, or the ships disguised as merchant ships. You know, and I was with several people who were prisoners of war, various times of surface raiders. In fact, a particular friend of mine in Rhyl, he was on his first trip to sea in the first week of the war, first month of the war anyway, 1939, very early days anyway, on his first trip to sea. He was captured by a surface raider and sent to Germany, spent the whole of the war as a POW in Germany. And a lot of other people have been captured. I always remember one, the third officer of a ship, I was still a cadet now, he'd been captured by one of these armed raiders in the Caribbean somewhere, and they kept them on board for a couple of weeks, I think, and then the Germans thought, well, you know, we don't want this lot, they're just eating us out of house and home anyway. And they mustered them on deck and said, there are two lifeboats here, and he said, the German captain said, and they were taken from a British ship, just as they were on the British ship. He said, if the third officer of that ship has been doing his job, those boats have water and food in them. If he hasn't, hard luck. Put him in the boat, and he said, you've got 200 miles to go, you know, in that direction to South America. They're in the South Atlantic. Luckily, there was food and water in the boats, you know. So that was about the worst sort of thing I heard of. Of course, there was the Altmark crowd, you know, but they were rescued. But I think the captain of the Altmark, he was an exception. Most of the surface raiders had very good reputations. I mean, the Grass Space captain, as we all know, Langsdorff, was a gentleman, and you know, he eventually, as you probably know, he committed suicide in his area. But most of them were that time, you know. And there were far more, you know, I say about hatred. There was far more venom on a ship directed always towards the chief steward or the cook, if he wasn't a good cook. But actually, most ship's cooks are good cooks because they have to be, you know. They wouldn't survive otherwise. But, and against the owners, you know. You know, the owners were always, I mean, some were quite good at, I suppose, my ship owners, and I mentioned them, were average, you know. But
what were the common grievances against the owners?
Oh, well, food, obviously. I mean, they're all sadist. I must admit, actually, in the Harrison line, the food was quite good. They were known as Hungry Harrisons in Liverpool, or the Apple Daddy boats, because you got Apple Daddy every Friday, which is an apple pie thing, you know. Again, you see, during the war, we victualled always in the United States or Canada. You know, we never victualled at home because of the shortage of food. You know, we always took all our supplies abroad. And we got very good food. It was all, and frankly, there was no rationing, of course. I mean, people at home were living on one egg a week, I suppose, and things like that. But when we had many eggs as you wanted for breakfast every morning and things like that. So, chief stewards were in the company were not liked by anybody because they used to try and cut down things, you know, save money for the owners, sort of thing, you know. And so they weren't. In fact, in those days, again, deck and engine room weren't very palatable. You heard, probably heard the old expression, oil and water doesn't mix. And the only time we did all join forces against the unfortunate chief steward. I was with one chief steward. He weighed something like 23 stone, I think. He's an enormous man, you know, like one of these sumo wrestlers. And he never dared go to bed at night, you know, get in his bunk, because he knew he couldn't get out, you know, once he laid flat, it'd take all hands on the cook to get him upright again. And he knew pretty well if we were torpedoed, you know. Sorry about that, using the word. But, if, you know, we were torpedoed, nobody would really put themselves out to rescue him, you know. So he used to sleep in a chair all night. And
this was on the Harrison line.
This is the Harrison, yeah, yeah. And he was, and the other thing that I'm often asked about was the sort of not animosity or anything. What were our relations with the Royal Navy? You know, well, really, everybody had great confidence in the Royal Navy. You know, and their the way they protected convoys and that. And you know, very often there was a marvellous cartoon in Punch during the war, and it showed an enormous merchant ship. You know, and you know, a huge thing about 40,000 tonner or something, and this cartoon, and it was bristling with guns. It had guns everywhere on it, you know, and you know, it looked like a battleship really, but it was a merchant ship. And a small trawler appeared alongside it with about three men on it and one little pop gun, and it was White Ensign, you know, it was a naval trawler. And the officer to watch is leaning over the bridge of this huge merchant ship, saying to the captain, "We're all right now, sir. Our escort's arrived." You know, there was this feeling of trust, actually. However, amateurish, some of the obvious people in the Royal Navy were. I mean, they were civilians, perhaps only a month or two before, and they pitchforked into the, you know, Battle of the Atlantic, and. It was. The only time I ever heard any criticism of the Royal Navy, in all the years I did see anyway, was after the PQ-17 thing, when the Navy apparently, or appeared at that time, to have abandoned a convoy. And they, of course, after some time, when the full story got out, we realised, you know, why it had happened, you know. But at the time, everybody was convinced that the Navy had ratted on the job, you know.
This was the famous Russian
call. The Russian call, yeah, PQ-17, yeah.
Did the Merchant Navy men think that the Royal Navy was better off or worse off than they were in the war?
I don't think they thought that way. At the beginning, they thought they were better off because the merchant seamen didn't have access to, you know, some of the facilities that the service people had. But as the war went on, of course, I don't think anybody really sort of envied the Navy in any way. A lot of them, of the merchant seamen generally, are pretty individualistic lot, and they wouldn't have taken to the discipline, you know, that sort of thing. But I don't think the Navy had rather, they didn't resent us very much, except that they were under the mistaken idea that because seamen, again, not cadets or officers, but, you know, rating, because they got paid overtime, for instance, they thought, you know, we were highly paid. They always thought merchant seamen were tremendously highly paid. We weren't very much more paid, received more pay than the Royal Navy, but because they knew that seamen got overtime, you got naval ratings usually, not so much officers, but you got naval ratings saying, well, and then there was this, coming to another bit in a sec, I may as well talk about this now actually. I've said that in general the morale and everything of merchant seamen was pretty high. Obviously, as the war went on, of course, it became grimmer just through length of time, I think. Young ones coming in, they were full of gung-ho and all the rest of it. But the older ones, you know, I mean, they were pretty weary towards the end of the war. Now,
could you tell me about the degree to which the Merchant Navy suffered casualties during the war? Because I believe that they suffered the first and the last casualties.
Yes, this is quite true, of course. The first casualties of the war were merchant seamen who were in the Athenia, a liner, the Donelson line, that was sunk in the Atlantic within hours of the war breaking out on the 3rd of September 1939. And I should imagine, in fact I'm pretty certain, that the last casualties of the war would also have been merchant seamen, because even when the shooting stopped, of course it was a long time before all the mines were swept, and ships were still being sunk by mines long after the war finished. The casualties were pretty horrendous, actually, because we had over 32,000, including Commonwealth seamen, and a lot of Indian Chinese seamen amongst them. And it's quoted in CBA Barron's official history of the Second World War. Okay. It seems not unlikely that a quarter of the men who were in the Merchant Navy on the outbreak of war, and perhaps even a higher proportion, did not survive until the end. Although presumably that cannot be verified, the official figures show that pro rata Merchant Navy casualties were higher than any of the armed forces, whilst over 5,000 British merchant ships were sunk by enemy action.
Now, we've been talking about the North Atlantic convoys, but I believe that you went to the Mediterranean after this. Was this still with the Harrison Line?
Yes, it was, and still in the same ship, the Settler. We had to go around the Cape, of course, because the Mediterranean was more or less a no-go area at the time. And we went to Alexandria, and this was in October 1942, and we were discharging our cargo there, and I was actually quite close, of course. Alexandria is about 60 kilometres, I think it is, from El Alamein. When the Battle of El Alamein commenced, we'd had several air raids while we were in Alexandria, and there was always scenes of great panic in the local population when this happened. And Alexandria had already been evacuated once, and the whole fleet had gone up to Haifa, but they'd come back again. And on the morning of the Battle of El Alamein, about 3 o'clock, I think, in the morning, the whole of the sky suddenly lit up with this tremendous bombardment and noise. And we thought, hello, Rommel's coming, you know, can't be us doing this. And all the locals presumably started getting out all the German and Italian flags ready to wave as Rommel marched in. And early next morning, at 7 o'clock in the morning, a hospital ship came in, one of Elder Dempster liners, and tied up just ahead of us. And we were, as sailors do, watching it tie up. And a fleet of ambulances came down to the quay, and we all said, yes, this is it. We'll be evacuating the wounded first, and the rest of us later today. And they started carrying the wounded on board the hospital ship, stretcher cases, and then walking wounded, and looking at them, we said, what mob's this? They're in funny uniforms. And of course, they were all Germans and Italians. And this was the first indication that perhaps we were onto a winning streak. And about 10 o'clock that morning, it was announced that, in fact, you know, the 8th Army were